Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 722. This episode is brought to you by Tales of the Borderlands, episode 4. I am intimately familiar with this project as I play Vaughn in Tales from the Borderlands, which episodes 1 through 4 of Tales are available now on Xbox 360, Xbox One, PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4, PC, Mac, iOS, Android. The remaining episode will be released to download during the fall. Save money and get exclusive unlocks in Borderlands, the pre-sequel, by buying the Season Pass. But if you played up to this point... Man, I don't want to give away too many spoilers, Katie, but just if you played up so far, I'll just give you some broad strokes that Reese, who's played by the amazing Troy Baker, who is god of voiceover, he and Fiona are forced to continue searching for a vault beacon at gunpoint, and then some other things happen I don't want to give away, but can you make tough choices that you need to succeed in this game? Tales from the Borderlands is a blast. It was hilarious to work on it. And I've gotten, you know, especially for a video game, I've gotten really good feedback on it, Katie, which really makes me feel like it restores my faith in humanity.
Awesome.
Yeah, the people have been
like
very
it.
Nice to me in Tales of the
People like your voice.
No, that's not true. Some do, some violently don't. But anyway, Tales from the Borderlands, Episode 4. Please, please, please play it, Episodes 1 through 3, and then play Episode 4. What do you got on the Nerdist Community Corkboard, KT?
There's a guy named Rodney Hines from Raleigh, North Carolina, and he's better known as the No Hand King. And this person that wrote and said, if you live in Raleigh or the surrounding area, you're likely to have seen him riding a wheelie on his bike all over town. He even does it long distance. He's trying to raise funds via Kickstarter to ride a wheelie across America and make a documentary about the ride.
Riding a wheelie across America?
Yeah.
I don't know why. For some reason, that sounds dangerous.
It sounds cool.
It sounds cool, and it sounds... But that's
and
why it's cool.
This, you know, if you want to go and support him, you can go to Kickstarter.com and just search the No Hand King.
No Hand King. All right. I'll also promote the Fun Comfortable Tour because I'm off for a few weeks, but then picking it back up. And I got a Texas run starting September 17th, Houston, Dallas, Austin, 17, 18, 19. And then the following week, Buffalo and then Toronto for JFL 42. So go to FunComfortableTour.com to get tickets and info on that. This episode is Owen Wilson, who is promoting No Escape, which the movie looks so awesomely stressful. I mean, in the sense of like, oh, like it's just, it's a great, like edge of your seat kind of...
Thriller.
Kind of a thriller movie, yeah. Kind of an escape movie, really, even though it says there's no escape. There's God, I would hope there's an escape.
You have to see it to find out.
You have to see it and find out. It's in theaters August 26th. And we were able to pin Owen Wilson down for a podcast who was actually on my podcast bucket list.
Oh, yeah?
He was one of the names. There's still a lot of names on the list, but Owen was on there. And he did not disappoint. So I'm excited to get into this episode, but I also want to tell you really quickly this episode was also brought to you by our buddy Dimitri Martin.
Dimitri?
Dimitri has a brand new Netflix comedy special. And I'm told he's going to be talking about acoustic guitars, hairless cats, color schemes, the word nope. So Dimitri Martin live at the time is now streaming on Netflix, and you should absolutely support comedy in any way that you can see stand up and support
so
Dimitri on Netflix as soon as you can. And now here's the Nerdist episode number 722 with Owen Wilson.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Crazy. I can't believe she's doing 5 shows at Staples Center.
They sold out instantly and then sold out.
That's like YouTube business.
Yeah.
I think that's even crazier.
Yeah. Do people love
it? Well, U2, it's better than U2 because U2 has to divide it by 5.
that's right. Taylor Swift is one person.
One person.
Yeah. What if we just talked about Taylor Swift for 45 minutes? Is that...
We can't afford not to. Stand her good
grace. I mean, seriously. She's going to be...
Sinatra now.
She is.
Running thing.
There's going to be this weird, like, tween mafia... That that watches over.
She made Apple Music bow down to her. That's power.
Isn't that crazy? That was amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah, we're in the wrong business. We should have been 22-year-old country turned pop stars. I think.
Yeah, I guess that. I guess we, you know, just one more thing when we lay our bed down to sleep and regret.
It's not too late. I think it's not too late for us. I think we could still pull it off.
Well, I think we could pull off the 22-year-old. And I am from Texas,
so that is...
Oh, you have picked up the karaoke. I'm dying to see
Thank you. What karaoke?
Well, aren't you and Woody going to that karaoke thing? Or is that just something, that joke that I read?
Well, we were in Malibu, and we were at this place, Cafe Habana, that does a karaoke.
Doing the karaoke?
Well, no. Pete Farrelly was doing it with the guy from Empire of the Sun, who was really there. He was a great guy who was singing his songs.
I'm all excited. And
we were what? Yeah.
Doing.
If you were going to karaoke, what would your song of choice be? No. Listen,
if you don't love me by now, maybe.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a really good one. Now, let me ask you this. Are you would you try for real to sing it, or would you like comedy it up?
I'd try for real. That would be a good one to have played at like a funeral too. If you don't love me by now.
All right.
You will never.
I got a pitch, Funeral Crashers. It's just a whole movie of people just crashing funerals and singing inappropriate songs.
Yeah.
As loved ones are being buried. I think it's fun. And it kind of gets you into the Taylor Swift thing that we were talking about before.
All roads lead back to Taylor Swift these days.
She is the thread, the fabric of the universe. She is the dark matter in the universe that ties everything together.
Yeah. The net.
She's the net. What if we just found out she's not a real person?
Yeah.
She's just a sentient expression of the internet.
That's Sandra Bullock.
She's passed the crown down.
That was ahead of its time.
The net was yeah.
Movie,
the
like
net.
At the time you were thinking, well, what is that, the net? And now you understand what it was. But
they control everything. No one says the net, though. Even at the time when that came out, people were like, I don't know if anyone says
the net.
No one says the net. You know, hey, man, I'm going to check the net. You guys, do you want me to get you anything? No. What are you going to check? That's not a thing. Are you an internet person? Do you spend an exorbitant amount of time on the internet?
I'm a net person.
Are you a net? Are you a net? Are you a netter?
I was very offended when you just went on that little run about how no.
No, I'm sorry. You know what? That was really. I apologize. That was really inappropriate, and this should be inclusive. And that was.
Well, not wildly so, but I do. I guess like everybody. You do go on. I wish sometimes that you went on more for sort of positive things, but I do. You do find yourself sometimes getting, even if you go to ESPN, all of a sudden there's like a little thing like, 15 child stars you wouldn't recognize now, and all of a sudden you'd like, before you know it, you've clicked on and you're looking at these things, and it's like, I just wanted to check the score of the Red Sox game, and now I've been sucked into this negativity.
Yeah, I like how hypocritical I get with that stuff, because I'll go, well, this is terrible.
Yeah.
It's like 16 of the ugliest babies. Yeah. That's mean. Wow, 14's awful. Oh, my God. That's terrible. What a terrible baby. Like,
right, you wish you were kind of looking at more like, great poems and like, great quotes from Churchill. And you do, but a lot of times the internet seems to steer you towards some of this kind of negative stuff. But I did have a friend recently recommended, this history podcast that I did start listening to that was great. And so, yeah, it's fun when you
What's
find
it called?
Something good. The Hardcore History, it's on World War I.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it says Dan Carlin. And you realize that if you did, he's such an engaging person, the way he kind of explains this stuff, because I feel like, well, I kind of know how World War I began. It's, Sarajevo, the guy got assassinated or something. But when he kind of lays it out, it's really interesting. And it's reminds you of how lucky you were if you ever had a good teacher, because I don't feel like I, like most people, that you have a lot of great teachers in your life. There's like a few that are like, and what makes them great is that they're like super engaging and it makes learning fun.
Well, obviously there is the sum total of human knowledge available in our in our phones at all times. We have the sum total of human knowledge on the net.
Right. It's really cut down on our ability to BS.
but you don't even know
good yarn.
You don't even know what's real anymore, though. Like,
well, that's the thing. There's so much. I mean, the nutrition stuff is like trying to get an answer on, you know, are blueberries an antioxidant, or, you know, it's there's so much conflicting stuff on any kind of like health questions, but I find I always am kind of, you know, white rice, good or bad? Well, there's, you know, you can find a bunch of things that say it's good,
this
and then
good.
You got to be eating brown rice, and then no, brown rice is, this is why our family went back to white rice. And then you read that article. So I wish that you could just get, or if there was some, that there's probably a room for like an app that like was a very reliable person. You know, the way like, you know, they used to have most trustworthy people in America, like Walter Cronkite would be like number one. Somebody, there's room for somebody like that on the net.
There is somewhere.
But somebody then, who, you know, you could rely, you could take it to the bank if it's coming from this website, that it's pretty good.
But I think it's dangerous to even be that person, because then
too much power.
There's too much power, and then too far to fall.
Yeah.
Because everyone's human. And people, you know, people see these two-dimensional representations of folks on TV, and I'm just going to keep calling it the net. I don't give a shit. We're bringing it back. I'm going to sound like a douchebag, and I don't mind. People see people on...
It does flow off the tongue in
really
a way.
It really does make sense.
Makes me think that, like, you know, those marketing people at Sony, when they changed the title from the internet to the net, knew what they were doing.
Some poor guy whose life was ruined when that movie bombed, and now is like, I've been vindicated! I'm back! Trying to get his job back. But I think, you know, you just don't know who to trust, and people are human, and they have so far to fall now, because there's always someone that's going to dig up some shit on a guy and go, oh, but then 20 years ago he wrote this, which means, and there's just no, I don't even know what's true. I sometimes I feel like we're living in the Matrix, but a lot of times I just feel like it's a weird misinformation matrix where nothing actually makes any sense.
It's a hall of mirrors, you know, with, you know, contradictory stuff that is, you know, difficult to untangle, because you can just sort of go down a rabbit's hole with trying to. I keep going back to nutrition, but that's the thing that I'm always seem like I'm. I get interested in finding out about, and
what do you know so far about nutrition? I'm in the same realm.
Well, I got interested because I read, I guess, something in the paper about this, the Blue Zone thing, and where they did a study of you know, five places in the world where people live, you know, tend to live really long, you know, to like 100, and there's one actually not far from Los Angeles that's like Seventh-day Adventist, which I don't, you know, it's some, I don't know, some religious group. And then there's a place in Japan, an island, some place off like Greece. And what it seemed to be suggesting in this was that one thing that they had in common was not a lot of meat eating. And so, you know, that kind of, because then that sort of, what about the paleo diet that they're now saying, well, if you get, you know, grass-fed beef, that it's actually really good for you. So that's what I mean about trying to find out, well, you know, what's good for you and what's bad for you. I'm sure it's like everything. It's like stuff in moderation, but...
Yeah, probably. And I wonder if in some of these Blue Zone strips that people are not exposed to a lot of outside...
Yeah,
not a lot of outside pathogens are not allowed outside. Yeah. I think basically the rule is...
a healthier environment. And I know that one thing that they did point out was a sense of community and feeling a part of something and sort of eating with a group and, you know, taking walks. So it's not so much about, you know, kind of doing, you know, intense exercising as just being active throughout the day and kind of moving around.
Everything in moderation. Don't eat lead paint.
Yeah.
That's bad. But then everything else in moderation.
Or what's that horrible thing that you hear advertised by kind of ambulance chasing lawyers?
Mesothelioma.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still not 100% sure what that is.
I don't know what
the Noma
it is,
makes it sound really bad.
I feel
bad.
Like it's in like yeah. it's in that kind of stucco that has the kind of the bumpy texture.
I don't
know if that's it, but you know, I feel like it's that's you know, where it
you know,
comes
you,
from.
You know, we look back like in the 20s or like the early teens at the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, and we're like, those fucking morons had asbestos plates. What
yeah,
were they thinking?
What were they thinking?
Their silverware was
yeah.
made of lead. You know,
yeah.
and,
or your grandparents, you know, smoked when they were you know pregnant and stuff. Yeah, yeah. Throughout their lives, and then they'll look back on stuff that I'm sure we're doing.
I know that's what
their
I'm gonna.
Cell phones.
Oh my
god! They
literally
had them.
They were into their fucking heads. What were they doing?
Didn't they start to catch on with the brain tumors? But no.
And when they weren't next to their head, they put them next to their balls. What were they doing?
I think a big thing, though, that they will sort of identify is stress. I mean, they're already starting to, but the connection between health and your mind and just, like, feeling, you know, being really stressed out or sometimes even if you, like, are on the freeway and, like, you know, you come close to, like, an accident, you get that sort of surge of, like, something of, like, adrenaline.
You feel alive.
Yeah, but it's, I'm sure, like, having that stuff course through you. So people that are like ragers that you know, cannot be good for you.
No, I think we have a finite amount of energy in yeah. our bodies. And
well, that's what I feel about, like, you know, running marathons. I feel like there's like a limited amount of tread,
yeah.
you know, on your tires. Or are you going to just like burn it out like training for marathons? Or
yeah.
are you going to like, you know, just sort of take it slow?
I think it's yeah, because I think when you are stressed, so much of your energy is devoted to being stressed. That's when I feel like the other stuff gets through.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then you get sick or you're just not...
For sure.
Yeah.
yeah. The way you can get, like, sick after being, like, you know, yeah, really stressed.
Well, I just think it's silly that we spend so much time pursuing happiness, but it's rare that people are just like, oh, I'm just happy. I'm just happy.
Yeah,
I'm just
right.
happy. Like, oh, I got to do this thing and it'll make me happy. Like,
yeah, I gotta
what if you were
this,
just happy?
This and this, right.
Yeah.
yeah.
What if you just enjoyed the thing that you're doing instead of... But for some reason,
maybe
it's just always out
maybe
there.
Maybe it's Jefferson who kind of got us off on that track by saying the pursuit of happiness.
Motherfucker.
It's like, God. We can't just be happy. We got to be pursuing it.
Thanks a lot, Thomas
yeah.
Jefferson. For a second,
yeah.
I thought you were like, maybe it's the Jeffersons. I thought you were talking about the Jeffersons. Moving on up to the east side. They're building it. They're showing an
keep
impossible
it up.
Dream.
Yeah, you can't do it.
You know, it's expensive on the east side. There's no way those people can move on. This is crazy. Yeah, I think the constant pursuit of something else, and especially this entertainment business is very unforgiving with that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Did you have any idea when you... Well, Bottle Rocket was what? Almost 20 years ago, right?
It was 20 years ago, and more than 20 years ago. Yeah, it's... you know, when I was with... We were just working on Zoolander in Rome, and Ben... Stiller was somehow we're talking about Gene Kelly, and you know he's great and Singing in the Rain, all these movies. And then Ben was saying that his career, you know, that sort of window of those movies being popular were only like 8 years,
oh,
and
wow.
then like you know it sort of shifted, and so. You know, somebody that kind of beloved, it's hard to imagine that, gosh, he only had like an 8-year career.
But then there was just no, there was so much less of everything.
Yeah.
And there were, so everyone watched.
From musicals. Yeah.
Yes.
No more musicals, no more guys like singing and dancing. That just kind of changed. Yeah.
That didn't really carry into the 60s.
Yeah, no.
The 50s and the 60s wasn't really about dudes dancing a whole lot, going on dates, on shore leave.
Yeah.
Just going for a dance to the streets of Manhattan.
Yeah.
We got a couple days. Let's go dance down Park Avenue. It's beautiful. I just think
it's nice walking along the street, but what I'd really love to do is just dance down it.
I like to imagine I think it'd be really fun to imagine that if you were in Gene Kelly's reality.
Attack, but first we dance.
No one else there can hear the music. So I think it's for them, they're just watching an insane person dressed like a sailor twirling around a light post. if you're in the road, like, what is this guy doing?
Yeah.
I'm curious, when you started, when you guys, because I remember when Bottle Rocket came out, and it was sort of this bit, and it was really that period of, it was really just the ramping up of, oh, guys can kind of just go out and make their own thing, and it's really cool. And that really helped usher in that age of the, you know, the industrious kind of like, hey, let's just pull up our bootstraps and go make a fun thing, and it can actually become something.
Yeah, I think I remember I went to the Sundance Film Festival, and we had, Wes and I had written the Bottle Rocket screenplay, but then seeing Reservoir Dogs and the way that movie began and the conversation about tipping and then Madonna and just thinking that it was just kind of one of the best things I'd ever seen. And I think it kind of actually got us to change Bottle Rocket, because then it became so popular that we had a beginning to Bottle Rocket that was talking about an episode of Starsky and Hutch that then maybe seemed like it was too much, too derivative of Reservoir Dogs, of that scene. So then it shifted to talking about exercising and working out, as you could see that my interest in health and nutrition predates this podcast
by a couple decades in a weird sort
right of so yeah, I've been pursuing that knowledge for a while, but yeah, it's you know, the movie, you know, we sort of, I remember Luke and I kind of, you know, walking along thinking, gosh, what's it going to be like when Bottle Rocket comes out? Because we just kind of assumed you make a movie and then, well, everybody sees it and everyone knows who you are. And God, it's going to be hard for us to even to be next to each other, because it's going to be, there are those guys from Bottle Rocket. But that fear was... you know, quickly proved to be, it wasn't going to be a real problem after Bottle Rocket opened to about, you know, less than a million at the box office for the life of its run.
But it really, that movie became a calling card for,
well,
you guys.
Well, and it did, because somebody was asking me earlier about, you know, is it important, you know, how a movie does at the box office and reviews? And I was like, yeah, it's really important, because it just, you know, it helps. Obviously, if they do well, then they give you money to do another one. But then I was kind of thinking about Bottle Rocket did no business and didn't get, you know, that good of reviews. But it certainly kind of lives on, you know, with people coming up, you know, mentioning that movie more than they ever do The Haunting.
Right.
Or something that would have, you know, made a ton of money, but they just sort of disappear. So it is the idea that you can sort of do something, and that even if it doesn't, you know, get a big audience early on, that some people will find it and embrace it if it obviously, if it speaks to them. And you know, that seemed to be what happened with Bottle Rocket and even kind of Zoolander, because we're doing a sequel 14 years later to a movie that didn't do very well. it kind of reminds me of, like, when I was reading something about Neil Young, and he was talking about his trans phase, where he, you know, did the electronic music, and I don't think it went over very well with his audience, but he wasn't taking a back step, and in fact, he was quoted as saying, like, you know, I'm going back to that music, and I'll either be 1,000 years ahead or 1,000 years behind, but I'm going back. And that's kind of what it seems like with Zoolander. Like, we're going back. We're going to do a sequel. I don't know if there's an audience there, but we're doing it.
But I think that's ultimately, because sort of like with Bottle Rocket, and I think with a lot of stuff that you've done, I think the story around the movies is just as important. Like, the story around you guys making Bottle Rocket, or the story that, you know, you and Ben and this group of people seem to genuinely be friends. And yeah. So, and these things kind of spin out of your friendship because you go, hey, it'd be fun to do this. That is, I think, almost as important as the actual things themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder if sometimes those, you know, the fact that you're friends works its way into the movie. I'm sure it does. The fact that, you know, with Bottle Rocket, that, you know, doing it with my brothers and my best friend, I'm sure that kind of feeling works its way in. But but then there's lots of other movies that, you know, I'm sure start out the same way and then, you know, maybe don't work.
But I think it doesn't really, I know it matters to a degree how things do because it depends on what your next thing is. But I also feel like, you know, if you look at anyone's career, some stuff hits and some stuff doesn't hit. And it's, but if you just stay in the game and you, you know, and you can still keep it fun.
And that's, and I guess that was the, you know, sort of the important thing with Bottle Rock is that it did well enough, at least with some people embracing it, that, you know, and they gave us a chance to do Rushmore. And then, you know, you kind of keep moving. And I do think there's something to be said with not putting so much, like, you know, weight onto anything, that you've already moved on, that by the time it kind of comes out, it's like, you know, yeah, I hope it does well, but if it doesn't, it can't catch me because I'm already gone.
You've already made three more things.
I'm already dancing through New York City.
Yeah, Jason Schwartzman's been on the podcast a couple times, and he's legitimately the nicest dude.
Yeah.
Like the sweetest, most genuine, which is so funny.
Yeah, he was calling me, well, I've known Jason forever, but then when we were playing Brothers on Darjeeling, we spent a lot of time, you know, in India, just kind of sitting around waiting for them to set up the shots. But he is like just so nice. And I started calling him Question Man. And he started calling me Quote Man, that I do get from my dad, because my dad would always send, you know, notes to me in college, and it always was built around a quote that he had read. And I have, like, kind of, you know, adopted that, where there's no situation that doesn't make me think of a quote from somebody. And so Jason was calling me Quote Man, but he also is Question Man, because it's always like, where'd you get that shirt? I just love it. I'd love to get a shirt like that. Well, yeah. And so he's so, just so disarmingly nice.
And then you respond with, men should not want, which that he the possesses. Just that endless loop of conversation.
What's one man doing asking another man where he got that shirt?
Do you find that different times of your life are sort of represented by one quote? Can you distill this period in your life in one quote? Is that how you see it?
I do know that there's some quotes, that there's a few, like, that are like track one off my greatest hits of quotes. That once more into the breach, dear friends, once more, is one of those quotes that's so applicable that you can always use it. Basically, anytime you're kind of tired and, well, we got to go back out there. Once more into the breach, dear friends, once more. So there's those kind of quotes that are just very serviceable for any situation. And that came from, you know, seventh grade English class, where we had this great teacher, Mr. Conley, and that was one of the poems that we had to learn, and that's Shakespeare.
Is there a quote that was sent to you where you said, I don't know what this means, but I'm afraid to ask because I don't want to look foolish, so I'll just assume that it
means something. I kind of felt like that about that movie about, I guess it's based on the spy, Kim Philby, and all the stuff, you know, with, you know, those Cambridge spies in England that were double agents for the Russians, and that movie that came out with Gary Oldman, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Oh,
so
right.
I watched the movie, and I could feel that this is a great movie. I never could understand what was going on. It made me feel really stupid because I couldn't figure out, who is this? Do we trust this? Like, but it was like one of those, I was too embarrassed to say, you know, I just don't get anything that's happening here.
You're just saying to the theater, anyone else got a line on this?
But it really was a good movie without understanding it, you know. And I also felt that a little bit that way working on Inherent Vice, where I couldn't quite understand. I've never read Thomas Pynchon. and I had a hard time following, but you feel like this is, you know, it's got to be good because
people say it is. Yeah. It feels important.
People are very
yeah. Well, what is Pynchon? His books are known for being sort of experimental, or we'll have to check the net on this.
We'll have to check the net. I just know all my super smart friends.
No way.
Love it. Yeah. They know it. Yeah. They love it. Yeah. Oh, Inherent Vice is going to be a movie.
Pynchon-esque.
It is. Oh my God. Yeah. Should we take the kids out of school? What are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to do?
Yeah. Yeah.
But, can you watch a movie just as an audience member, or do you,
I have a hard time watching if it's like, you know, if it's, you know, a really close friend or, you know, in it, because it just, I don't know, it's, it makes me nervous for them. It's sort of, you want it to be good. And so it just makes me uncomfortable, to watch it. But, you know, sometimes, you know, yeah, you can still, it helps when you don't necessarily know the people in the movie to kind of be able to get into it. You know, foreign movies. But then sometimes movies are so good they're foolproof to that. It doesn't matter, you know, who's in it and how well you know them. The movie's just so good and their performance is so good, you just, you forget about that.
Do you have a phrase that you say when you've seen someone in a movie and you didn't like the movie and you don't want to hurt? I guess what I mean is, like,
well, I do say that, like, you know, it does seem like in, you know, in Hollywood that you have to measure things in degrees of greatness, because no one ever says something's less than great.
Right.
You know, so I'll go to the premiere tomorrow night and, you know, I'm sure afterwards people, you know, everyone's, oh, that was great, that, you know, and I do the same thing. And you kind of have to, because first of all, the movie's already done. So what can you do to help it at this point? And, you know, they're not looking to have you say, ah, didn't work for me.
You know what you guys should change? Well, that we can't. Right. We're sort of done.
You know, if it really... you know, I would just say, wow, great job.
You really, I mean, that was a movie. That was a movie.
What can you say? I just like, just was transported.
Have you ever been in something that you were like, ah, shit, and then someone said, that was really great, and you're like, you don't have to say that, please.
I feel that way every time.
Do you really?
I always feel like.
No.
I remember the Midnight in Paris when they showed it in Cannes, and afterwards just thinking, this thing just bombed. it just feels like that to me. That's why I have a hard time watching stuff that I'm in, because I know that I always react really negatively to it. It just never... You have this memory of it, like, doing it, where it seemed kind of good in your mind, and then you see it, and it's just like, what were you on about there, mate? What were you thinking? Who are you fooling with this stuff? And but then I can swing kind of wildly back the other way, where, like, 3 years later, I can be, like, in bed flipping through the channels and stop on a movie I was in and be like, this is great. This is unbelievable. Like, why didn't people make a bigger deal out of this movie? So it's like, I feel like I'm sort of, you know, I'm either too high or too low. I don't have the ability to just sort of be kind of, you know, just to appreciate it and, you know, pretend, you know, be objective about it, I guess.
Well, I guess that's why it's important to just, you know, pick stuff you think is going to be fun, have fun on it, and move on to the next thing. And if you know that you have that reaction, it might not be a real thing. It might not be real.
Right. It might not be real.
Because if you have that reaction all the time, it's like, oh, my brain is obviously...
Well, I remember I thought it sort of began with Bottle Rocket, with the test screening process, where I was sort of forced to go. And, you know, we had one on the Santa Monica Promenade, and it seemed like a third of our audience walked out. And I think that was so traumatizing, you know, that always sort of affected my ability to kind of watch stuff. Because you can say that, like, well, they're not walking out on you, Owen. They're walking out just on, you know, this character. But it feels like that's you, especially if you, you know, wrote it. You know? It feels like a pretty personal rejection.
Well, it's a very vulnerable place to be to throw something up on a screen to make something, because you.
Well, then I remembered that. Then I thought, okay, well, that was just Bottle Rocket. And then I remember working with Jackie Chan and on Shanghai Noon, and I saw some of the early, reaction. Like, we got like a good review from the New York Times, and it seemed like, you know, the movie tested well. And I remember going to that premiere, going, well, I feel sort of insulated now. And 15 minutes later, I was like, I got to get out of here. This is the worst thing I've ever seen. So it didn't matter. It's like what you were saying. The way I process it, it's just very uncomfortable and awkward for me to have to sit there and watch stuff.
Maybe you should have a rule where you will not watch. There's like a 3-year rule. It's like, I'll make stuff and then I won't watch it for 3 years.
That's basically kind of what I do try to do. It's obviously not constructive, because it can't be that negative. It's funny how that works.
But you're so, I mean, like, but it's
well,
so
I wonder about people directing themselves, like, you know, to be able
I don't know
to,
how
like,
you do that.
You know, go back to the monitor and edit stuff. But you probably get used to it. I'm sure it's probably like public speaking. You sort of probably get over seeing yourself and it being sort of strange and awkward, and you kind of get used to it, and then you're able to sort of judge it, the performance, by its own merits.
Or maybe they either lean heavily on the editor, or they can disassociate themselves.
Or they
and
just
it's
have
like
a huge ego.
This guy's great, more him. Well, that's you.
Great.
Yeah. He's really good. Cut everyone else out. I don't give a shit. Cut everyone else out. But I think, you know, I feel like so many of the guys, and you in particular, you have been able to bounce around to so many different types of things, because like, you could have just done silly comedies, but you didn't. You can do dramatic stuff. You can write stuff. And do you feel... And No Escape looks fucking amazing. Like, it's... This trailer is really stressful. Mm-hmm. Really, really stressful in the best... And, like, in a good cinematic way.
Yeah. Well, that's what I felt when I was reading the script, that it felt like... Oh, yeah. And at this point, you got to, like, get your kids off the roof, and you're going to have to throw them. This is going to be gnarly.
I was making horrible jokes with my girlfriend was on the train. I'm like, shit, take three. You know, I did this earlier. I'm sure I can get the next one over the... I swear I can do this. Can I just one more try?
And I do. I mean, that was kind of... I think sort of imagining myself playing this character, I couldn't really see myself sometimes playing like a real sort of superhero type character, but I could see myself playing a father who, you know, loves his kids and, you know, would do anything to protect them, because I think that's pretty basic to fathers and to, you know, most human beings. You know, you want to protect your kids, even if, you know, even if it's just a child, you know, somebody else's child, you have that instinct to protect a kid. So I thought that when I first read it, it seemed like kind of like it could be a exciting story, you know, because they were adding that. It's one thing to kind of get yourself out of trouble, but now you got to deal with, how do you get your two kids out of trouble and your wife also. Although she was kind of helping me.
Does it feel the same when you go into a movie like this as opposed to, you know, if you go into Zoolander or Wedding Crashers, where it's like, oh, I know everyone and we're going to go fuck around and have fun?
It does feel the same, because it's always sort of a little bit, you know, it's sort of the same kind of tension every day when you go to work, that you're trying to make it sort of in your mind feel like, well, that's pretty good. You know, I always feel like that on, you know, almost every movie I've worked on, that at some point there's like a feeling that sort of a collective hypnosis where everyone starts to think, or at least I fool myself into thinking, like, this could be a really fucking good movie. And obviously not all the movies I've worked on have worked, and there's been plenty that didn't work at all, but still, at some point during even the ones that didn't work, there was a feeling that this is pretty good. I think what we're doing is pretty good, because I think it's too hard to go to work every day to think that you're just making something lousy. And the few times I've had a bad experience on a movie was because I could never even get clear that hurdle of thinking that. So just the whole process was like, this thing does not work. And that's a real
and you got to finish it.
And you got to finish it. And it's just like, that's not a fun way to go to work. So, you know, there's no difference for me, you know, working on No Escape or working on, you know, what I was just working on, Zoolander. It's that still that, you know, where you kind of look around and you're like, yeah, this, I felt like that scene worked. And the director says, yeah, that was good. I think we got it. Okay. And everyone's kind of, you feel the energy on set when it feels like you sort of are getting it right. And so in that respect, they're not that different, you know, from each other. The hard part is when you can't get that feeling, or when you're doing something and you like, I don't know if this is working, and you kind of look around at the crew and they're kind of looking off and stuff, and so that's kind of, no one will make eye contact with you.
You just described the same, what you just described is like when you're on a flight, when it gets really turbulent and you just kind of look at the flight crew, you're like, okay, do they seem okay?
Yeah, right.
Because I will freak out if they freak out.
And there's something about being like, you know, actors that you are sort of, you know, children's make-believe and stuff, and you're always kind of looking to, you know, the director is the, you know, the parent figure. And I've seen this with, it doesn't matter how old you are, you know, how established you are as an actor, there's an instinct, a feeling that you finish a take, they yell cut, and you just look, you know, to see kind of what the director's reaction, because you can see on their face before they've said, that's great, or anything, you just sort of see. And I sometimes wonder, even with... you know, where sometimes you see the frustration with somebody who's been acting for a long time, who starts to sort of, you know, get that feeling of like they don't want to be, you know, now they're, you know, in their 60s and they're looking to, you know, some 29-year-old, and they're mad at themselves for doing that, but they can't help it. And that leads to their kind of frustration with acting. What am I doing? Like, I got to look for that guy for approval. But there is that, it's just that instinct, because you're kind of a kid playing the scene, trying to do it. They yell cut, and it's like, did we get it? Or are we moving on?
Because it's impossible. Entertainment is so subjective, and there's so many different ways to attack something that it's just not linear. It's not like, you know, well, my goal was to sell 100 soda pops today, and I sold those. Like, you have that benchmark, but you don't know. There's so much riding on so many different points of view. How are you supposed to know? How do you even get stable?
And it is so, you know, collaborative that there's – I remember Jim Brooks, who produced Bottle Rocket and kind of gave us our, you know, big break, saying that there's the movie that you start out shooting, there's the movie then you sort of discover, you know, when you're actually shooting it, and then the one you find in the editing room, and how it can always be sort of changing, because there are so many sort of moving parts. And I think that kind of goes back to that sort of thing I said, that you can kind of, you know, hypnotize yourself into thinking that I think this is good, this could be pretty good, and, you know, then afterwards you see the movie and it's like, this thing didn't work at all, just because there's so many things that have to fall into place, I think, for a movie to be good, I think.
With your with your collaborations with Wes, those movies have such a specific... And I don't exactly know. I know you know what I'm talking about. I don't know exactly how to describe it, but there's a thing about them. Like, when you see that, when you see those names together, you go, "Aha! That's a thing that I like."
Yeah.
Do you know what that is?
Yeah. Well, I'm not. I mean, to me, it would be Wes. It would be, and this has kind of become a popular word that I don't love, but, you know, a brand. People talking about a brand, but, you know, Wes, his, I think his movies, and visually, they're just instantly recognizable in that world that he sort of creates. That you just kind of, you see a preview and it's like, well, there's no one else who directed this. It had to have been Wes. Yeah, who knows where he... It's Bottle Rocket's slightly different, probably, from, you know, isn't so recognizably that way as, you know, than Rushmore. Began with the curtains pulling back and stuff. But that was, that's, I guess, just Wes's sort of visual signature. Yeah.
What's your favorite part of the... What's your favorite way to tell a story? Is it writing, or do you like performing? Do you enjoy the acting part of it?
Yeah, I have fun acting when you hypnotize yourself into thinking that, you know, everything's working. But when you said just telling a story, I think that even sitting around with friends or sitting around with your family, at least the way it worked with us growing up, a lot of it was, you know, if everyone was in a good mood, your dad was in a good mood, you'd tell stories that, you know, you've told a lot before, but everybody still sort of, you know, loves hearing the story. They know it, but you kind of, and I think that, you know, maybe sharpens your ability to kind of hear what works with a story, at least when you're telling it to friends and to a group. And then that must be what happens with, you know, directors and stuff, when they, you know, as they kind of hone their craft, they get better at kind of knowing, you know, what works and what's going to work. I mean, there's, I don't know if there's a better feeling than, you know, it's rare, it seems like, you know, that you find a book where you're kind of excited to get back home and actually start reading it again. Or when you see a movie that you really can, you know, just lose yourself in, that you didn't necessarily expect anything. I always bring up that movie, and now it's been a while since that movie came out, but that movie, The Lives of Others, that was that won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. It's probably, you know, 8 years old or something now, but that was, you know, one of those examples of just putting in a movie. Okay, I don't know what this is, and you start watching, and it's just all of a sudden it's the best movie you've ever seen, and that's an exciting feeling. I used to think about when I was working in Blockbuster, sometimes people would come in, they'd want a suggestion, and you'd recommend a movie, and I'd think, God, wouldn't it be great if you'd never seen The Godfather before, and now you're going to go home tonight and see it, you know, or if you'd never read, you know, this, you know, Huckleberry Finn, and now you're going to get, you know, to read that. There's always that chance when you're, you know, working on something that
Blockbuster Video. Completely forgot about Blockbuster Video. I mean, I knew it was a thing for a long time, but I just hadn't even thought about it.
Yeah.
It just disappeared, and I don't think about video stores anymore.
Yeah, they're just gone.
Did you like working at Blockbuster Video?
Well, it was only one summer, and I was, you know, not really great at the computer part of it. So they would just kind of have me out on the floor, you know, doing the security tag on the candy and stuff. So I would just kind of be sitting there. But it was nice because they would let you bring home, like, you know, three movies, so you could get as many movies, watch as many movies as you wanted. But yeah, Blockbusters, like, they just came and went, didn't they?
Yeah, it just the net
swept,
claimed another victim. Blockbuster Video
just clawing on the troll. Just blowing off into the universe.
Poor Blockbuster Video. I don't know. When you were growing up, were the types of movies
that guy must have made a ton of money, because I think that there was a Blockbuster Bowl, or, you know, and did the guy who started Blockbuster, did he own the Miami Dolphins, maybe, or am I imagining?
I don't know, because there was also Blockbuster Music too, right? Yeah. Wasn't there the music part of it?
Well, those, I mean, all those, like Tower Records, all that stuff's gone, you know.
But, I know. Colin Hanks made a documentary about Tower Records.
He did?
Just all about sort of like the... Like,
well, like Borders and, you know,
Borders
places. Yeah.
But that's, you know what, and I think it all ties back to everything that we've been talking about, which is those were The one thing the net did, the net did create virtual communities, but the thing that it killed was the sort of in real life communities. And I think, accidentally tying it all together, those were fun experiences to go to the video store, to go to bookstores, to go to record stores.
Yeah.
You're communing with other people and exchanging ideas in person.
And you know, you said communing with other people, and I do think that sort of as human beings we have that instinct to be, you know, a part of a community, which takes us back to the Blue Zone.
Right.
And living to 100 and feeling, you know, that you're a part of something. No one wants to feel, you know, like a free agent, like you're Travis Bickle, just like this, like, you know, alienated loner. You want to feel, you know, connected.
Find your Blue Zone.
So, yeah, find your
Incidentally, you're wearing all blue. You are the Blue Zone at the moment.
You know, by any means necessary.
But I loved hearing about, you know, you were saying your brothers and your dad were together and exchanged stories, that part of community. And then also, I think seeing how you've come up in the last 20 years and then seeing you work with the same people over again, that feels very communal too.
Yeah, I do think the way that I've, you know, ended up working with Ben so many times, and Wes, and well, it's fun to work with your friends, and you don't you can sort of, it's the same way with your kind of brothers. You don't have to go through that, you know, kind of awkward, you know, tiptoeing around the other person,
right?
You know, you can sort of you know, be more you know, straightforward immediately right off the bat.
Did it feel that way when you guys went back to Zoolander? Like, oh,
no. Even as I'm saying that, I don't quite believe, because I think I really do have to tiptoe around Ben. And I'm sure he has to tiptoe around me a little bit in the beginning, because you don't want to hurt somebody's feelings. You know, I don't know. Yeah, if what I was just saying necessarily applies, but maybe you get over that feeling quicker, or maybe, you know, maybe the fact that you have to sort of, you know what you have to sort of tiptoe around, the other person, you know, you kind of have a shared sensitivity, and that's why you were sort of friends in the first place.
Or at least maybe. If you have a history and you step on an emotional landmine,
yeah,
you can go, hey, I already know you.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah.
And then you know it's not, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just remembering us, like, being out one night in Rome, and I had this T-shirt that I thought was, like, a pretty cool T-shirt that I guess was maybe, like, slightly kind of retro. And, you know, sometimes you put something on, you're not quite, you know, sold on it, but you're like, I'm going to give it a shot. Let's just put it in the starting lineup. You're going to go out there, and like you're kind of sitting there, and there's a group of people, and you feel good, and it's like, I think I made the right call with this thing. You know, this is one of those walk-ons that's now in the starting lineup. And then Ben said, I love that shirt. And I was like, really? Yeah. And he goes, yeah, I had one when I was 7. And just instantly. And it was like trying to bring back like those rugby shirts kind of that you did wear when you were like a kid, that I was thought, well, maybe their time has come around again. But
you just stand up, fuck you, man. The shirt's rad. You just don't want to admit it.
Right.
You're just mad you didn't have one. You know what you should do is, when the movie wraps, you have to send him a box of those shirts. I couldn't help but notice that you admired my shirt.
Yeah.
Here's a bunch for you.
And then, actually, Ben was saying, no, the shirt does look good. Like, it wasn't, it sounds like he was doing that joke. It looks good on you, but he really, no, it does. I'm just kidding you. He was just kidding.
But that sounds like that sounds like the Caddyshack thing. Oh,
yeah, it
looks
good.
Looks good on you, though.
Yeah, right.
I just saw the most awkward, someone posted the most awkward junket interview with, it was Chevy Chase, Ted Knight, Bill Murray, who else? One of the other guys from Caddyshack. And this woman was interviewing them, this older woman, and it was like this 6.5-minute interview from 1980, and it was the most awkward. Oh, Bill Murray. Bill Murray was in it. Yeah, they were all in it. Bill Murray, Ted Knight, Chevy Chase, and they all seemed like they had been up all night, and it was weird. And I'm guessing. I just assume that between like 70 and 84, everyone was just on drugs all the time. But it was so uncomfortable because she was asking them questions about their characters and trying to make jokes as if they were real. Like with Rodney Dangerfield, she was like, "Oh, those clothes you were wearing," and he was like, "Yeah, it was a character supposed to be kind of obnoxious." So
wardrobe set them up for me.
But it's a really, if you ever feel like, oh, I've had to do a junket and it was weird and it was awkward, look it up on the net. And,
is it there? You can. It's on
YouTube.
Is it something you hear or something you can
you see it?
Oh, really?
I don't know who this woman was. They were
and
Dangerfield.
She's got all those guys in the room together.
It was at Dangerfield's comedy club in New York. They were all just there. And I don't know what blackmail information she had over these people because she was clearly not an interviewer.
Yeah.
It was just like your aunt. Like if your aunt was like, "I'll field this one." Chevy, your golf swing is weird.
Those are three people that you could see not having a lot of patience for, you know, wouldn't suffer fools gladly, but maybe they were nice to this old lady.
Ted Knight made the most effort to be accommodating.
Yeah.
But Rodney was just sort of like, "What?" And Bill Murray was very, well, I mean, I don't know. And Chevy Chase was just kind of acting like, "Why am I here?" You know, it was such an awkward thing. Just like seeing those dudes even back then and go, "Hey, I guess stuff hasn't really changed a whole lot. Yeah. These things are still really awkward." Were you a big Caddyshack fan?
Yeah, I think Caddyshack was one of those like videos that like our friends that lived down the street that they had like gotten from the video store and never returned. You know, you used to be able to rack up those charges, so they owed like $389
for like three tapes.
Yeah, for like three tapes, and they just they hung on to it. So they had that, and they had also Animal House. So also, a movie I remember kind of loving that was kind of like that was Used Cars.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That was a great one.
Kurt Russell.
Yeah, Kurt Russell is great in that. And, yeah, those were great. Those were those rated R comedies, and now it seems like is that a cyclical thing where now it's swinging back against R-rated comedies? Then, you know, they kind of like died out for a little bit. They're what I grew up with, where you'd see some kind of nudity, and then they kind of stopped, and it was like PG-13, and then with The Hangover, and they kind of became rated R again, and now maybe, you know, the R-rated comedies seem like they haven't been doing that great.
If you watch Caddyshack now and you're watching, you're like, there was no need for boobs right there. Like, it didn't serve anything. There's just
unless
boobs.
Unless you were 13.
Unless you're 13, of course
it
does.
And then it was like, yes. Finally, there.
But now if you have the net, you can see way worse stuff than just, like, a guy snacking on someone's boob. Like, you can see way worse stuff. But
Used Cars definitely tapped into that too, of kind of gratuitous nudity they were hitting.
I want my comedy with boobs.
Yeah.
And I want everyone to be on drugs in them. That's all I need. And I'm good. It's time, right? I can't believe this went by already. This completely flew by. But I think what we establish is community is important. And do you have a good quote that you want to send away?
Yeah, what would be a great quote to
if you don't know me by now, you will never, never, ever know me.
Done.
That's how we end the podcast.
That's it.
We all have our own funny mood. If you don't know me.
Perfect. But perfect. Amen.
I was waiting for you to pick up the chorus.
No, I can't sing.
Well, we're not gonna do this band if you're not gonna take it seriously.
Well, I'm gonna be behind the scenes.
Oh, okay.
You're gonna be out front.
Okay, good. All right, good. All right. I'm gonna go get my makeup. Okay. Thanks, man.
Okay,
good
thank
to see
you for
you.
Having me.
Enjoy your burrito, everybody.
All right.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.